But anyway, good morning, everybody. Welcome. We are here in the on the Journey Home with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and we are reading from the Ken Wapnick book of the same name, The Journey Home, and it is a discussion of the obstacles to peace from A Course in Miracles, which, you know, there's plenty of obstacles for peace to flow over, and one of them being the illusion of sickness and the belief that those that we love can be harmed and that we can be harmed. That's why today's lesson is so so important. These few lessons that we have now about who really is in charge, who really has the strength, who really can save me and the world and everything. Who is it? It is my God, who is an awesome God. He reigns in heaven above. You know that song? I used to listen to that song and laugh and think, do we need to tell God how great he is? But apparently we do. We need to tell ourselves how great he is. Which is why these lessons are so important. God is the strength in which I trust. But anyway, enough of me. Bruce, what's going on with you today?
Well, I'm fine. My wife is, speaking of, having a little challenge with her health, just a cold kind of a thing, but hopefully it doesn't get any worse than that. But, you know, so, yeah, again, those are the things that are reflections of, you know, a choice in the mind. But it's really just a microcosm of the bigger macrocosm, which is that we believe that we're separate, and that's the real illness. And that's what A Course in Miracles, I think, you know, reminds us that, you know, no matter what seems to be happening to our bodies, you know, that in truth, a healthy body is no different from one that appears to be having issues, only because bodies are not real. Now, this doesn't mean we don't do the perfect things and you know, have compassion and see the
water and
doctors
juice.
And do all those kind of normal things,
good,
right?
Yeah, her medicine was in there. Rinse it out and put some milk in it. Milk is upstairs in our room. So, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I wasn't sure if you like addressing a family member.
Yeah, my husband was asking me what was in the baby's sippy cup, so he can give her. And I should have just muted the mic while I was talking to him.
Oh, that's okay. But yeah, but these are the things that go on in our lives, and they're our classroom for forgiveness, aren't they? I mean, because we as long as we can remember that everything is either an expression of love or a call for love, you know, respond appropriately, huh?
Absolutely. And Carrie just posted, my Mr. Coffee quit working today. Good morning, Lynn. And yeah, you wake up, get out of bed, Mr. Coffee's dead. Remember that from that song? Is that Cheers? It's time where you could go where everybody knows your name. Yeah, everybody knows your name where Mr. Coffee's dead when you wake up. So.
I guess I never heard that lyric or paid attention.
Oh, yeah, well, you know me, I listen to all the lyrics of all the songs because that's my jam, is songs, music, and lyrics. That's my jam. I like that. Okay, so let us start looking at our reading, because I think, you know, that addresses all of these things that we're talking about and even more. And did we end on therefore the non-dualistic oneness, or were we just going to read that again? Can't remember why I put a bookmark here.
You know, I think we could actually just read this section over again, because there's only three pages left in the chapter.
Okay.
And if we could just, you know, do that, I think that would you know, wrap up. There's plenty there to recover, and then we have the context. How's that sound?
Okay, so we're doing the undoing of the ego through forgiveness?
Yeah.
All right.
How's that sound?
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Well, I'll read since I found it. Inherent in the four obstacles to peace again, the ego's defensive strategy to protect its individuality from the decision maker from the decision maker changing its mind, is their own undoing. In chapter 28, Jesus refers to the process whereby the Holy Spirit leads us up the ladder, the separation let us down. And that's chapter 28, section 2 and section 3. This provides, if you ever wonder where that ladder of separation is, chapter 28, 2 and 3. This provides us with the context in which to discuss the process of the ego's undoing, which is simple reversal of the ego's layering, uncovering these layered defenses to what lies beneath them until the final layer is removed, revealing the simple choice for individuality that was the beginning of the dream. The choice for individuality was the beginning of the dream. The following paragraph, which we shall consider again under the fourth obstacle, nicely summarizes this process of uncovering the layers of the four obstacles until the love that has been concealed is allowed simply to be. And here is the paragraph. Every obstacle that peace must flow across is surmounted in just the same way. The fear that raised it yields to the love beyond, and so the fear is gone. Hey, that's today's and tomorrow's lesson. And so it is with this. The desire to get rid of peace and drive the Holy Spirit from you fades in the presence of the quiet recognition that you love Him. The exaltation of the body is given up in favor of the Spirit, which you love as you could never love the body. And the appeal of death is lost forever as love's attraction stirs and calls to you. From beyond each of the obstacles to love, love itself has called. Love is calling us. You get that? Love is calling us. That's why we have this yearning to do this work. Love is calling us. Love itself has called, and each has been surmounted by the power of the attraction of what lies beyond. Your wanting fear seemed to be holding them in place. Yet when you heard the voice of love beyond them, you answered and they disappeared. That's today's lesson. You know, we're looking at our fears and we're listening to the voice of love. And as we look at these fears and the answer that we have is that what? God is the strength in which I trust. And as I look at these, let's see what it says in today's lesson that we're supposed to do. Today we go where was it that he says what it is that we're doing here? So if you're trusting in your own strength, you have every reason to be apprehensive, anxious, and fearful. What can you predict or control? What is there in you that can be counted on? What would give you the ability to be aware of all the facets of any problem and to resolve them in such a way that only good can come of it? What is there in you that gives you the recognition of the right solution and the guarantee that it will be accomplished? Of yourself, you can do none of these things. To believe that you can is to put your trust where trust is unwarranted, and to justify fear, anxiety, depression, anger, and sorrow. Who can put his faith in weakness and feel safe? Yet who can put his faith in strength and feel weak? God is your safety in every circumstance. And so today we are going to take 4 or 5 minute practice periods where we're going to close our eyes, repeat the idea of the day, and then look for situations in our lives that we have invested with fear, and dismiss each one by telling yourself, God is the strength in which I trust. By telling yourself, God is stronger than my fears. God is stronger than my weaknesses. God is the strength. And He is not holding it back from us. He's absolutely offering it to us at every turn. And we're the ones who are deciding whether or not we want to accept God's answer. So Jesus says, yet when you heard the voice of love beyond them, you answered and they disappeared. Thus is the miracle's work complete. For now the Son of God is free to choose again and can replace the ego with Jesus as his teacher. All traces of the dream fade into nothingness as the Son of God, reunited at last with the whole Sonship, is at the journey's end, will, quote, disappear into the presence beyond the veil, not to be lost but found, not to be seen but known. And that is from the Obstacles of Peace, text chapter 19. And so, you know, Bruce, you have anything to say about that, or you want to read on?
Well, there's always plenty to say, as we've discovered, and several years of conversation. It just seems like we're always, presented with an opportunity to let go of, our investment in individuality, as you were tying today's workbook lesson together with the reading, it's just obvious that. More and more that we need to turn this little willingness of, maybe begrudgingly once in a while do, spare a few minutes a day to remember a workbook lesson, to eventually, because we see the contrast is so great between, following the ego's insane strategies to their illogical conclusion compared with Holy Spirit's gentle curriculum of undoing that craziness, and the results are so profoundly different in terms of the amount of peace that we feel. It's not like a measurable thing. It's just that it's totally different. It's like it's just kind of like there's when you're in that awareness that that peace is not only possible but all there is. The insanity of the ego just becomes more and more evident, and we can watch ego's 24/7 blather stream with gentle amusement and just say, "No thanks, I don't need to go there anymore," and that takes a lot of practice though, because we still think that there's something there that we're going to benefit from trying to do it on our own. That's sort of John Wayne, all I can do it myself thinking, but at some point we recognize, the only thing that really works is letting go of the individual approach and using the totality of Spirit as our guide. And I think that's what as you were reading that, I was thinking, that the first, where he talks about the layering, I was thinking, well, the choice for individuality, the first paragraph you read was the beginning of the dream. I have this acronym called GIST, which I find helpful, which is guilt, which includes, of course, sin, guilt, fear, and the whole ego's whole thought system. Individuality for the I, and space, time, or the S and the E in that acronym for GIST. And it's really, I think, using Ken's progression here, it would be IGST for individuality, and then guilt, and then, it's basically the idea that, we shattered heaven, and then the space-time, we made up a whole world to hide out in, and so that we could stay away from our mind. But once we realize that, the world isn't working, we checked out, checked off the list. It doesn't mean we stop doing the normal things, but we can check that off the list as, potential solutions to the problem of lack of peace. When we get back to the mind, we realize, well, the only way to undo the guilt is to get to the cause of it. And, as he's always saying here, then what disappears is the dream of sin, guilt, and fear when we forgive ourselves for believing that it was even possible. So, and this is, again, just it reiterated in so many wonderful ways that help us, highly resistant, seemingly slow learners, all reach the same conclusion, even though we probably all do it by very different routes, but we're all headed to the top of the same mountain or the same ladder or whatever metaphor you want to put. Should I read on a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And so Ken goes on, and what is it that Jesus teaches us but the truth of the atonement principle, and in a form that we can accept and understand? The atonement states that the separation from God never occurred. I think those five words are really the source of our salvation. The separation from God never occurred. And therefore, the oneness of heaven has never been compromised nor affected. I mean, we can read those, and it sounds like a nice intellectual, concept. But until we get it, and really, every fiber of our being resonates with that, we still have some forgiveness work to do, it would seem. Anyway, it is this oneness and this alone that must be taught to minds that believe only in separation. Enter here the holy relationship as the teaching device used to reach minds trapped in the illusion. This, quote, tactic, unquote, on the part of the Holy Spirit of dualistically reflecting non-dualistic truth is summarized clearly in the following important passage from the beginning of chapter 25 in the text. I'll just read these three paragraphs in chapter 25. Since you believe that you are separate, heaven presents itself to you as separate too. Not that it is in truth, but that the link that has been given you to join the truth may reach to you through what you understand. And then in brackets, Ken has, i.e., the language of duality. Father and Son and Holy Spirit are as one, as all your brothers join as one in truth. Christ and his Father have never been separate, and Christ abides within your understanding and the part of you that shares his Father's will. The Holy Spirit links the other part, the tiny mad desire to be separate, different, and special, to the Christ to make the oneness clear to what is really one. In this world, this, and then Ken puts non-dualistic truth in brackets, is not understood, but can be taught, and then in brackets, dualistically through symbol and metaphor. The Holy Spirit serves Christ's purpose in your mind so that the aim of specialness can be corrected where the error lies, because his purpose still is one with both the Father and the Son. He knows the will of God and what you really will. But this is understood by mind perceived as one, aware that it is one, and so experienced. It is the Holy Spirit's function to teach you how this oneness is experienced, the holy instant in brackets, and what you must do that it can be experienced, in brackets, forgiveness, and where you'd go to do it, in brackets, relationships. So there's the whole curriculum right there.
Right there.
All of this takes note of time and place, in brackets, the world of duality, as if they were discrete. For while you think that part of you is separate, the concept of a oneness joined as one is meaningless. It is apparent that a mind so split could never be the teacher of a oneness which unites all things within itself. And so what is within this mind and does unite all things together must be its teacher. Yet must it use the, brackets, dualistic language that this mind can understand in the, again, brackets, dualistic condition in which it thinks it is. And it must use all learning to transfer illusions to the truth, taking all false, once again, brackets, dualistic, ideas of what you are and leading you beyond them to the, in brackets, non-dualistic truth that is beyond them. So here Ken, basically points out using the Course's, seemingly religious terminology of how, the Christ being the awareness that, is really beyond duality, whereas in our conventional religion we tend to associate that with a specific person, which is totally missing the point, because the Christ really is all about oneness, and tag, we're all it. and if we weren't, it wouldn't be the Christ. So anyway, but that's the curriculum that is required for us to use relationships in order to go beyond duality. And those holy instants are when we are actually willing to let go of our something that doesn't work, just you know, releasing our grip and letting the the dust crumble into the vaporware that it really is, you know. Anything you want to add to that before we go on?
No, that's pretty well put. And again, it's the relationship. It's the emphasis on the relationship that and we are so as egos so opposed to having a relationship that's a holy relationship, because we think we can control relationships by having rules and having ideas about how this relationship should go and who's in charge of this and who should be doing that and why would you treat me this way and why wouldn't you treat me this way. And you know, we have all these rules about relationships, and so ego is looking for someone who's going to follow the rules. You're going to find a relationship that's going to be holy because that person's going to follow the rules, and so we're going to have a good time. But the truth is that no ego will follow the rules. Because the ego made the
rules.
Certainly
not Holy Spirit. It'll follow its own made-up rules.
Exactly. So it has these made-up rules, but the point of the made-up rules is to fail. You have to understand, the ego's entire plan is for us to fail. And so if you join a relationship based on the ego's rules and the special relationship situation, then it has no... it's 8:55. It has no choice but to fail. It's going to fail because it's based on, you know, it's the house built on the sand, you know. If you build your house on the rock, then you will, you know, absolutely fail. It will fall. And so it looks to me like I need to get my granddaughter something to drink. So I am going to actually just mute my mic and go get something real quick.
Okay.
And let you continue on reading and talking, but again, you know, it's our choice to join in a holy relationship. That's the only thing we need to do, and that is what brings about all of this relief, because then we begin to be able to join in truth and peace, and it is a good thing. Anyway, I'm turning the mic back over to you. I'm going to mute it and go get my baby a drink.
Sounds good. And you know, using the example of Lynn's errand for the moment, you know, it's really the spirit in which we do everything. Is it? Oh, I'm annoyed because this is interrupting what I'm doing, or is this every bit as much a part of my mind training curriculum to see that everyone's call for love is really my own? And you know, if someone's asking me for help in some way, I need to see it really as my call for help. And that, I think, is really a hugely helpful perspective, because anything that helps us undo the belief in separation, you know, is fair game. And there's, I think, categories of ways that we, you know, hold out. We have our sacred cows, so to speak, of well, I can believe on a conceptual level that I'm, you know, the same as X, Y, or Z, but maybe not A, B, and Z. Or for some people, maybe A, B, and Z is fine, but not X, Y, and Z. So, you know, we just kind of need to look. And that's why the end result's the same, but the curriculum seems highly individualized in terms of our relationship classrooms and all the things that seem to be things that challenge us, and our patience and our willingness to be patient with ourselves. You know, it all gets back to, you know, being willing to see everything as my call for love or an expression of love, and that the alleged other is really no different from self. And if that's the case, then, you know, getting someone a glass of water is getting yourself a glass of water. So,
exactly. Well, and oh, what is this? Listen to that exact thing. He said, you know, if a guy asks you on the street for a dollar, and you take a dollar out of your pocket and he puts it in his pocket, he's actually putting it in your pocket, because you are giving to yourself. You can only be given to yourself. And so, you know, if you're getting someone sustenance, you're getting yourself sustenance. Joel is so clear. Oh my gosh, it just blows me away to listen to him. Because honest to God, you know, I think his might have been the voice that Helen heard when she was writing The Course in Miracles. What Joel Goldsmith, he says exactly the same thing in just equally clear way, that there is no individual, you know, I have this and you have that and we are here and you are there. We are all one and the same. And, you know, when Jesus says in the Course...
I hear a Beatles song.
Yeah, me too. In fact, I was singing that Beatles song when I was listening to Joel Goldsmith. Because... and also, I Me Mine.
They were pretty tuned in a lot of ways, too.
They were pretty in, and I can only say that LSD is not the... demon that people think it is.
Nothing to get hung about.
But you know, that's it. If you could only understand that what I give to myself, and what I receive from myself. Everything is coming from this one source. And so, you know, if you could only understand that, you wouldn't think that you had something your brother didn't, or your brother had something you didn't, that they had something that you needed, and that somehow you had to coerce them to give it to you, or any of those things. You have everything. God gave us everything when He made us. You know, He says that in the Course, you know, He made you and
exactly.
I gave you everything, you know.
Yeah. And the everything is with a capital E in terms of the metaphysics of the Course. Last night we were watching Bill and Melinda Gates on Colbert's show, I think it was, and I was thinking, you know, he's, you know, by the world's standards now, only the second richest person in the world, you know, next to Jeff Bezos, and said, you know, we're not talking about that kind of thing, having everything. We're talking about the capital E everything, because, you know, no matter how, you know, busy philanthropically, you know, these self-made or whatever, you know, billionaires, trillionaires, whatever, are, there's no way that, you know, that could be anywhere in the same ballpark as the abundance that this curriculum is talking about, that we're all the recipients of, because, you know, we're just dreaming that we split apart and had to clamor for, you know, our little piece of the pie, and it's a pretty limited pie. If the pie is limited to, you know, just one planet in the cosmos, let alone, you know, one portion of a planet, and no wonder this is a world of lack and, you know, apparent lack. But the reality is that, you know, we're all at home dreaming of exile.
Yeah.
It's just kind of silly, isn't it?
But it's
so easy to get involved in the level of confusion, thinking that, well, I have to give, you know, on a material level. And there's nothing wrong with giving or not giving it on a material level. The important thing is really, am I willing to give everyone the same innocence? You know, would I accuse myself of anything that I see that appears to be a withholding of spirit or an expression of lack of love kind of thing.
And that is the key. I'm still go on.
Anyway, that just seems like, you know, that's at the crux of, you know, the Course's curriculum is to have, you know, all give all to all. And the only way we can do that, obviously, is to go beyond the material form and to recognize that if we're all... Each seeming separate self, or SSSS, as I think of it now, is silly seemingly separate self, just a mere, you know, reflection of the capital S self that we all are and share. If we're all of spirit, and that spirit is completely innocent, then no one lacks anything in truth. But we have to give that in each specific relationship in order to heal the specifics. We have to, you know, in every interaction, we can make a holy instant, as the Course would phrase it, or a, you know, perfect moment, as Bob Rosenthal talks about in the third chapter of his book, which we just talked about the other day. I've got that conversation on ACM blog if anyone's interested. It was pretty interesting. But it's the same thing. It's that those epiphanies where we realize, wow, I have and am everything, and so is everyone else. then the only way to keep that in mind consistently and feel the peace of that is to share that innocence, to share that willingness to go beyond the form and see through it. It doesn't mean you ignore the sensory data. It just means like an optical illusion. I think those magic eyes posters are such a great example of how, you know, the ego, looking at a superficial level, just sees this random pattern of dots, and you know, just there's no meaning there. But if you look beyond that, look through it, so to speak, you see the pattern there. And I think that's exactly what A Course in Miracles is in a sense, metaphorically, asking us to do, is to look past the form to the content of the mind, and to see that, you know, we're all the same, and it's that sameness that really then gets, you know, it becomes the gateway practice that leads us to the oneness. Because we don't really know what oneness is. I mean, that's where Ken is talking about, you know, oneness in the, you know, this last paragraph here is, you know, from chapter 25 here says, a oneness mind is one, you know, we don't get that. we have no idea what a oneness joined as one is. But we can certainly practice the idea of sameness, of recognizing that they're really, we're all in it together. We all have the same three parts of mind. We have the same decision-making faculty, the same insane thought system of the ego, and the same 100% sane thought system of the Holy Spirit. And, you know, having that choice brought back to mind more and more consistently, and seeing the contrast between the outcomes and the experience of, you know, choosing one over the other, eventually is enough to show us that nothing peaceful ever comes from the ego. It's only because we vacillate back and forth, and it's sort of like, you know, ego is kind of like a politician who says, well, I can take credit for all the things that are happening, but really it's our choice for the Holy Spirit that is the, you know, is the is the only reason that we've had any peace, and because we can't sustain an ego binge for very long before we go nuts. And so, you know, that's why in A Course in Miracles it says you're no longer wholly insane, because I think we recognize that you know, trying to make it about ourselves, whether, you know, cleverly disguised or not, just doesn't work, and we have to go beyond our limited sense of self in order to find any kind of happiness, even in the world's terms at some point. But in order to really go beyond the, you know, extreme limitations of this dream of space-time, which is an illusion, we have to see that it's an illusion. We have to see that our sustained persistence in trying to make it about ourselves at the expense of someone else, you know, just is counterproductive, and it's just a hopeless desert wasteland. And the only thing that leads us out of that to the oasis of peace is by seeing that we're all in it together, and then we wake up from the dream together.
Exactly. And it is a whole new language. This is what I've begun to realize, because as I was listening to you, I was thinking also about nonviolent communication.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
It's the same. It's a whole new language, and it's based on the idea that we are all the same, and that we all have the same needs and the same desires. You know, we are all in the world equal in the world. We all, there's nothing different about any one of us. I'm a parent. I worry about my children. I'm a body. I worry about my health. You know, I live in a house. I worry about my finances. You know, these are all the same thing that everybody else worries about. There's not a single person. I bet you even Jeff Bezos or, you know, the Koch brothers, you know, they're terrified about losing money. And that's all they do is try to gain more money. You know, you think you have everything, but no, you don't. You need more. And well, you know, Jeff Bezos is a good example of, you know, he has everything the world could offer, and yet look at what's going on in his life. You know, he's not having the most joyful life that you think you'd have if you never had to worry about money again. You know, he's going through all kinds of crap.
And the Koch brothers are probably worried about competition from Pepsi, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
I did say it.
But now you can get Pepsi in diamond-studded cans. I saw it on a commercial, and I was like, whoa! No, just not really, but it'd be cool. Yeah, it's so you know, it's this recognition of the sameness and looking for the samenesses. This is what, you know, instead of looking for differences and saying, yeah, but he did this, or they have that, or they are this color, or they have this, you know, heritage, or instead of looking at that, or, you know, she's so talented, or he's so handsome, or, you know, instead of looking at those things, look at the things that are the same about us. And concentrate on the things about, you know, we think the things that are the same are less, or not good, or not enough. But our sameness is the equator. You know, it basically brings everybody into a place of equality. And that is what's required for peace. Of Course in Miracles says it, you know, equality, the condition for peace is equality. And, you know, we're all equally screwed in this world. I could have said another world, but we are, another word, but we are. We're all equally screwed in this world. We all should be banding together to, you know, to join to make a better life. You know, that's what we should be doing if you had any kind of common sense. But what ego tells us to do is, oh, you better get what you can because they might get it first and then you won't have it. Because that's ego's thought, is that, you know, only there's a limited amount. Now, I used to be a member of a group, and you probably were too. I don't know. I may be still a member. I don't even know if it still exists. It was called the L5 Society. And I don't know if you know the L5 Society.
Well, I worked at a telecom group, which is a division of Grass Valley Group, in building L5, but I think that's probably something different in Northern California.
It could very well be good because, well, you know, L5 is the place in Earth's orbit where what is it that you could put something and it could stay in a stable orbit forever in this one thing, which I don't know if the L5 you worked on was something like that, some kind of a satellite or something.
No, this was a telecom communications, and it was part of a larger telecommunications corporation.
Well,
better part of two decades.
The premise was that if we could find a way to inhabit space in a stable way, then we could actually go out and mine the asteroids. We could go and catch things and bring them. So all the things that we perceived in this world as lack, you know, you could go up there and you could actually, you know, farm in space because you have infinite sunlight. You know, there's all kinds of things that you could do in space if you could be there without serious hazard to the body or whatever. And so, you know, the point was that we perceived that there was, you know, infinite resources and that all we had to do was figure out how to get to them. And so if we figured out how to get to the infinite resources, people would stop fighting over the resources here on Earth. But really what's going to happen is we're going to have a space force that's going to manipulate those resources.
It's a charming idea, but as long as it's based on a dualistic premise that, you know, that there's separate individuals, there's going to be a we-they underpinning. And as long as there's duality, you know, that whole premise is doomed. Not that we shouldn't do what we can to, you know, promote social and environmental causes and you know, equality on the level of form. But it's really the only place where it really is going to work is ultimately is in the mind. And I think anybody who's really reflected on the cyclical nature of you know, respite from war that happens momentarily in certain parts of the planet in apparent you know, placidness, and then the underlying seeds that are continually being resown in the belief in difference is, you know, it really, this ultimately is a hopeless desert. It doesn't mean that we, again, should stop doing what we're doing and practice kindness in whatever form we feel guided to do so. But ultimately, like Ken says, you know, when you recognize you're in the desert, the thing to do is leave. And the way we leave is not through any change in form, it's through a change of mind. And that's, that I think is, you know, one of the challenging things in A Course in Miracles is that, you know, we basically have to, you know, look at all of our attempts to, whether it's on this planet or off the planet, to try to make a dream, you know, sustainable, and recognize that ultimately, you know, a dream is a dream, and it's probably far more effective to, you know, do what we're doing in the level form, but with compassion and kindness and not taking it too seriously, giving it our best shot, of course, while, you know, using it as a classroom for getting back to the mind and getting back to how we can help each other be more mindful and kind, and make holy relationships the focus rather than making a utopian, you know, paradise kind of thing, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway.
Yeah, because it's all still the same thing. And like I said, you know, it would be, you know, someone would be taking over and running it because you can't.
Exactly.
You know, that's the way it is. So yeah. I'm going to continue reading.
Okay.
And let's see.
I'm just going to have one more comment.
Okay.
Let's say you have this you know, culture where amazingly everyone, you know, becomes enlightened and gets it that you know, it's all about, you know, shared interest and going beyond the form to the peace of mind, and then, you know, let's say a whole galaxy that's got that. Well, there's still going to be other galaxies that because it, you know, the world of form is based on duality, that haven't matured to that point, that will be warlike and invade the other galaxies. You know what I mean? Anyway, it just goes on and on. So I think the whole point is, no matter how far you extend a dream, it's still a dream, and you know, the idea is to wake up from it. So
exactly, and so we can just keep building colonies in space all we want, and we're still living in the dream. So
sure. I mean, we did that with this country, you know, and
yeah.
You know, colonized, you know, a new hemisphere kind of thing, but you know. Well,
yeah, first, yeah.
Anyway,
okay, I'm going to continue reading. Let's not get into that.
Thank you.
All right. Therefore, the non-dualistic oneness and unity of Christ with God is reflected within the Son's dualistic dream by his joining with another in forgiveness, setting aside the belief in separate interests, the ego principle of one or the other, which characterizes all the special relationships of this world, reflects the Son's change of mind from the ego's principle of attack and murder to the Holy Spirit's atonement principle of forgiveness and joining. It is, of course, not an actual joining of figures in the ego's dream of separation, but the greater joining, which is in chapter 28, which is an amazing section, with Jesus, the greater joining with Jesus or the Holy Spirit in our minds, that undoes the ego's belief system. And this joining comes within the context of undoing our misperceptions of the various relationships in our lives, the specifics we made up to conceal the truth of our guilt within our minds. Changing this defense through forgiveness is what exposes the underlying guilt, allowing the light of Jesus' one truth to shine away the ego's darkness.
I like how Ken puts quotes around the conceal the quote truth unquote of guilt, our guilt within our minds.
Yes, the quote.
I think to me that speaks to the two words that start with you that I now use as the adjectives to describe guilt as unconscious, yes, because that's the concealment, but unfounded is the quotes, I think, gives rise to, you know, the understanding and awakening that okay, I have to look at the guilt in order to have it no longer be concealed. You know, I have to, you know, avoid the secret evasion and hidden reservation syndrome of the ego. But once I do that, and do that with the Holy Spirit looking together at the silliness, you know, and it's only seen as silly when we look at it with our inner kindness teacher, that we would discover it's unfounded. And the unfounded part is really, that's when we release it. We have to, you know, reveal the mind, but then we have to, you know, that part of the mind that is, we've, you know, promised ourselves never to look at. I don't want to go there, because we think that this guilt is horrible. And in a sense, it appears that way. You know, kind of like the Wizard of Oz. You know, he's got this monstrous thing up on the screen, and smoke and rumbling, thunderous, you know, sound effects, and you know, shaking the earth kind of thing. And it's pretty scary, but it's a projection. It's just a, you know, it's just a theatrical tactic used by the ego to say, don't go there, don't look at that. But once we look at it and realize that's just a massive smoke screen based on a misunderstanding. It's the misunderstanding, as the Beatles say, of all we see. Quoting again from Strawberry Fields. That when we see that it's a misunderstanding, that's when the unfounded part of the unfounded unconscious guilt, you know, kicks in, and we've at that point seen with the Holy Spirit's vision that nothing happened, that everyone's off the hook. Everyone is liberated from the scourge of our projected guilt, and our, you know, our victimhood is, of course, you know, the primary mechanism by which we promote that. And we can see that, you know, it's like, well, that's silly. That's just crazy. Why would I want to keep doing that? Because then I make myself miserable and everyone else, you know, drag them down with me in my mind only. But, you know, to whoever, I kind of reminded of that you know, joke of, you know, is this a private fight or can anyone join kind of thing? But that's kind of the, you know, the ego strategy. It's like, let's find a conflict and you know, jump in with fists swinging and swords brandishing. Anyway.
Yeah, well, it's exciting and entertaining. That's why.
Well, yeah, and again, the more challenging, again, probably, you know, the most advanced, this is for us, I guess we can probably understand, you know, curriculum is in that fifth stage in the development of trust, where we recognize, okay, I can forgive as a person, but ultimately I have to forgive myself for believing in that whole idea of personhood, and that's that sort of extended dark night of the soul that seems hopeless until we recognize, as it says, you know, each step is so heavily reinforced, and every time we're tempted to make it about the little less self, you know, we get this little smack upside the face, wake up calls like, wait a minute, I'm not at peace. You know, we get just like how we feel. If we're not at peace, it means we must have chosen individuality and the silly, seemingly separate self over the greater of Christ's capital S self that really undoes the ego and undoes the whole idea of individuality, which, as Ken pointed out in this section we reread this morning, you know, is really what caused us to, in our minds only, in a dream only, descend this ladder of separation.
That's very clear. Very clear. So do you want me to read? Or do you,
Sure. You want to finish the chapter?
Okay. This is why Jesus' emphasis in his course is on his students asking him for help to shift their perceptions of others. Once again, this perceptual shift in what appears to be our external lives, special relationship to holy relationships, merely reflects the inner shift from the wrong to the right mind, which truly undoes the original mistake. Forgiveness and the miracle are the names A Course in Miracles gives to the process of our making this shift under the guidance of Jesus or the Holy Spirit. And I shall be elaborating on this process throughout the book. We are now prepared to undertake our journey and examine in the sections in chapter 19 that describe these four obstacles to peace. We begin with the introduction to these sections. And so that's the end of that section. And really, the important thing here is that you can't do it on your own. I don't. Mm-hmm. You have to ask for help, because we've been doing this sense of independence that we have, that I can do this on my own, I can do this by myself. That is the ego basically saying, I know what I'm doing, and God doesn't. So, you know, you really have to recognize that I don't know what I'm doing. I am clueless about this stuff. And the only one who does know is the one I'm not asking. The one I'm saying, wait a minute, I think I got this now. And even when I start, you know, I ask for help and things start getting better. What's the first thing I do when things start getting better? Okay, I got this now. You know, you Holy Spirit, you don't have to help me anymore because I think I got it figured out. It doesn't work that way. You never take off the training wheels until you don't need the bike.
Yeah. And the only time you don't need the training wheels is after, you know, like using the Course's jargon, after God takes the final step, you know. And we go beyond, you know, temporary epiphany to constant enlightenment. And that's, you know, that's the end of what's beyond the curriculum. I mean, the end of this curriculum is really to go to undo the ego. And then the Course says, well, this, you know, if you've done all that, then you're at the beginning now.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we're trying to get out of nursing school here so that we could graduate to kindergarten kind of thing. And the nursery school that we've been in for some time is, you know, looking at this silly, seemingly separate self, and then deciding, not in any condemning way, but just seeing that it's not working.
Yes.
In very objective, almost scientific ways, like, you know, all the lab experiments I've done, testing this thing out over countless lifetimes, have proven to me that this is an ineffective approach. The efficacy of that insane strategy just isn't cutting it. So, I mean, it's time to drop that.
Exactly. And it's like Groundhog Day. You know, I mean, Groundhog Day is a perfect example of, I mean, it's a great allegory for this, because it was the same day for him every day. He kept waking up and going, oh my God, here I am in the same day again. But everybody else around, this was the only day. You know, and this is the first time they met him. It's the first time they saw him. It's the first time they interacted with him. So he had a chance to start anew in every relationship, every day of Groundhog Day. And when he got to the point where he recognized that to some extent, then there was a different day the next day. and that's what it is with us. You know, when we begin to recognize that, you know, we've just been doing the same thing over and over again, and it has not changed the outcome in any way at all. And, you know, we can see it differently. And it doesn't change for everybody else in the world. Everybody else in the world, you know, is just doing their thing. We're the ones that are going through this this mental inventory, this spiritual inventory, and looking at our thoughts, looking at our behaviors, looking at our actions, looking at our relationships. We're going through this on a daily basis, and once you begin to recognize it, you just recognize, oh, you know, this is the same relationship I had with Joe. No wonder I'm having a bad relationship with Jim, because, you know, I'm just carried it on to another person. Or this is the same relationship that I had with when my stomach was giving me problems. Now I'm having problems with my lungs. You know, it's the same relationship. I've just carried it into a different venue, but it's still the same thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you begin to realize that, you know, it's the same thing over and over and over, and there's a purpose for that. You know, there's a purpose for showing me my madness in every way possible, because I can recognize that I am not any one of those insane directions. I'm not any one of those insane characters.
Yeah.
And neither are you.
We're all free of all of those, aren't we? As you were talking about Groundhog Day, which obviously was referring to that wonderful movie that we all love, I was thinking about a conversation I had with Dr. Bob Rosenthal, who's one of the co-presidents of the Foundation for Inner Peace, and we've had several conversations. We're doing one chapter with each recording from his new book, From Nevermind to Evermind. And in this third chapter, we talked about these, you know, epiphany experiences. And we also kind of touched on the timeliness of Groundhog Day. And he briefly touched on and then elaborates in another audio that I put at the bottom of the post on ACI blog for this third chapter, previous recording of a talk he gave about Groundhog Day and Valentine's Day. And both very insightful commentaries on those. One of the things he said about Groundhog Day, not the movie, but the whole ritual, is, you know, the whole idea that you know, the groundhog sees his shadow, and that, of course, that brings into perspective the whole, you know, huge body of work about the shadow and the psyche and so forth. But, you know, you have to turn away from the light to see the shadow. And that was so simply stated, it's like light bulb moment.
Wow.
Duh. You know, what a great metaphor. You know, we have, in order to perceive a shadow, there must be something different. And there must be something that's different that looks away from the light.
Huh.
Instead of toward the light. And, because, you know, if you're looking at the light, you don't see a shadow. But if you turn 180, which is only possible in a dream, you know, you see the shadow. Anyway, thanks again, Lynn. So we're ready for chapter 2 next week.
Yay.
And I always look forward to these conversations. So
me too. Thank you, Bruce Rawls, and thank you everyone for joining us here on The Journey Home with Lynn Johnson and Bruce Rawls. And Bruce's website is www.acimblog.com. And also, please go and take a look at our beautiful new Foundation for Inner Peace website, which is www.acim.org. Is that correct?
Uh-huh. And yeah, you don't need the www's, but yes.
I know. I always say www. Because when I type it in the room, it looks like a link. It comes out.
Oh,
of the
yeah. There
so,
you go. Yeah.
But you don't need a WW. That's right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Bruce Ross. And I will see you next week. And right
have
now, turning the mic over to you, Carrie and Iris. This mic is all yours.